My name is Steve Cope. This is Steve Lynch, and we are product engineers in the geoprocessing analysis team, working on spatial analyst and geostatistical analyst and related things. And what we're going to talk about today is some of the tools in ArcGIS for creating surfaces. How many of you guys make surfaces? How many people have a hard time picking interpolation techniques? Figuring out if you got the right one or what's a good surface? Okay, you're in the right place then, because that's what we're here to talk about. So we're going to start a little bit at the beginning to understand some of the different types of surfaces that we create, different types of surfaces you might store in a GIS, and some of the data structures that we store them with, and some of the tools that we use to make them. But really the primary emphasis for today's workshop is going to be about interpolation, creating surfaces from measured points. So we're going to talk about this idea of an interpolation workflow. The workflow consists of more than one step of have data make surface. I know that's how we all try to do it, but there's reasons to do other things. We're going to explain a little bit how interpolators actually work, which will help you understand how to choose an appropriate interpolator. I'll spend a lot of time talking about some of the different interpolation techniques, and Steve's going to show us a lot of demos of different interpolation techniques and when to use them for certain types of problems. So hopefully at the end of this, you'll have a better understanding of what we mean by an interpolation workflow and a much better understanding of which interpolators you should be using and how to think about your data and the surfaces that you're creating. And if that's not enough, just come see us in the island and we'll help you further. So there's a lot of different types of surfaces that we deal with in a GIS. Everybody works with elevation surfaces, but we also have continuous surfaces. We call them surfaces. A map of a continuous phenomenon of things like soil chemistry or water quality. But we also have other kinds of surfaces like a population surface or an income surface or a disease occurrence. Some of those are things that are interpolated, and some of them are not. We'll talk a little bit about that. So, what kind of surfaces do you guys want to make? Well, we start with what is the input data that you have to work with? Do you have point measurements? Do you have some lines? Do you have polygons? Do you have a raster data set and you need to make some new surface out of that? And one of the things we think about when we want to choose an interpolation technique is, if we need some kind of measure of the quality of the surface as part of the output. So there are some interpolation techniques that will give us a secondary output that describes how good those estimated values are. Because it's always estimates, right? So we have measured points in space, and we know nothing about what's in between them, and we want to estimate a value there. So when we estimate that value can come with some measure of uncertainty. And some interpolation techniques actually give you that information. One question that we always want to ask, though, is what is this phenomenon that I'm trying to make a surface of? Is it measurement data, or is it count data, or something else? Vast majority of the time, it's either going to be measures or counts. And measures are things that somebody went out into the landscape and measured. I measured the height at this point in the landscape. I measured the pH of the soil at this point in the landscape, right? As opposed to counts, which might be something like number of people per square mile or number of trees per hectare or something like that. Now notice when I say that, it's number of something per something else. So we'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute, why that's different. And we want to think about, is there something particularly unique or odd about the data that we're trying to model? So is it a discontinuous surface? We'll talk more about what that really means in a little bit. That might sound a little odd, but it's very common, actually. And we want to think about the data, whether or not the highest and lowest values of the phenomenon have been sampled. And that has some impact on which interpolation methods we choose. Now, I'll give you a clue. Very commonly, the highest and lowest values have not been sampled. So because you don't know in advance where the highest and lowest values are, if you think about that, right? And then what do I want as a result from my interpolation? Do I want a raster as a result? Do I want a tin? Do I want contours? Do I want polygon aggregations? Do I want new estimates at other points in the landscape? Do I just want to know a predicted value at that point? I don't need a full continuous surface. I just need an estimation at a location, right? And as I mentioned, we'll talk about this idea of surface quality, or the quality of the prediction that we make. So these are all some of the things that you'll think about when you're trying to choose an appropriate interpolation technique. We have a lot of different ways that we store continuous surfaces in a GIS. Obviously rasters, which is what we're going to talk about the most today. Tins and terrains, which is a triangulated representation of the surface. So TIN stands for triangulated irregular network. A terrain is a particular type of database class for storing tins in a database. We store surfaces as points. So those point measurements that we have are actually a representation of the surface. They're just very sparse representations. And then it goes for LAS files as well, LiDAR data. It used to be very common to store surface information as contours or ISO lines. It's not quite as common anymore, but that used to be a very common way to do it. If you have a need for creating contours, we have those tools in the software. We also have tools for taking contours as input and creating new surfaces from them. And then we have another way in ArcGIS for storing surfaces called a geostatistical layer. How many of you guys are familiar with geostatistical analysts? How many people have a license for geostatistical analyst but don't use it? Awesome! We're going to get some converts today. So what a geostatistical layer is a way to store a description of a model of how to represent that surface that points back to the source data. So it's basically a file that contains a description of how to make the surface. And then we can generate that surface dynamically for you from those points. Then you can persist that out as different data types if you want. So the useful or nice characteristic of TINs and terrains is they allow you to maintain the accuracy of the measured locations. So the reason that triangulated surfaces are used a lot in very fine scale engineering applications is because the measurement that you make of a particular location, that measurement, that exact location, that exact value that you gave it is persisted in the data structure, right? And you can have very hard lines that represent, you know, a levee or the edge of a building or a curb strip or, you know, things like this. So the fact that we can have that really fine resolution, those sharp edges, are reasons that we might want to use a TIN model. But what we're going to talk mostly today is about raster representations of surfaces. So we're going to move off of the TINs. So there's a lot of different places in ArcGIS where I can find all these capabilities for creating surfaces and storing surfaces. So within Spatial Analyst, mostly we're talking about working with raster data and contour data. So we can take contour data in and create contours. We can take raster surfaces in. We can create raster surfaces. With the 3D Analyst extension, we can do all of that as well as work with TINs and terrains. In the Geostatistical Analyst, we can do all of those things as well as persist things as a geostatistical layer, as well as have the ability to output our model result or our prediction result as a filled contour polygon data set. And then we've also added some functionality to ArcGIS Online that allow us to create surfaces from points and to persist those as filled polygon contours. So, I spoke previously about these types of phenomena that were, you know, a measurement of something per some unit area. So those are things that we normally think of as a density surface, or sometimes people refer to that as a heat map. I'm not really a fan of the term heat map because it's not very descriptive about what the analytic method is. Some people refer to all of these things as heat maps. So I tend to not use that terminology. I only mention it in case it's familiar to you. A density surface is really looking at a count of things over some unit area, so a magnitude per unit area, population per square mile, trees per hectare, disease occurrence, things like this. So it's counts of occurrence. Whereas interpolated surfaces are about measured phenomenon, right? So the distinction there really is, if I'm measuring height of, let's say I'm measuring elevation, and I measure elevation over here, and I measure elevation over here. The assumption of an interpolator is that there's a continuous surface connecting those two points, right? That there's a trend there that I can follow. If I go over here and I count how many people live in this square mile, and then I go over there and I count how many people live in that square mile, what do you think, how many people live in between there? I have no idea. To assume that the density of people in between those locations is a constant function is incorrect. So that's why we're distinguishing between the concept of interpolation versus density. And I just said all that one, so we can skip that. So interpolation is this concept of transforming these measurements at individual locations into a continuous phenomenon, because we can't sample everywhere, right? Now, some phenomena that we used to sample in individual locations, we can now actually sample everywhere. So elevation, for example, you know, we collect with radar sensors, and rainfall, we can collect continuous surfaces from radar sensors. But a lot of things like, you know, soil chemistry or crop productivity and things like this are always measured at sampled locations. And the purpose of the interpolator is to estimate values in all those places that we didn't sample. So we have a lot of different ways that we can create surfaces depending on what type of input data that I have, whether it's continuous values measured at points, whether it's contour lines, as I mentioned before. We may have polygons as input that we want to create a surface from. We'll talk about that at the end. Or I may have some raster data that I need to reinterpolate into some other surface. We'll talk a little bit about that as well. So I mentioned this idea of an interpolation workflow. And that workflow is actually pretty simple. Really, it's about first understanding your data. And when I say understand your data, it doesn't have to be a particularly complex thing. We're just saying, you know, what does the data really look like, and what do you think the phenomenon is and how it behaves? You need to think about that a little bit, and we'll explain some of the pieces of that and how you think about your data. After we do a little bit of exploration of the data, we want to experiment with different interpolation techniques and parameters. The best thing you can do is not assume that the first time you ran an interpolation tool that you picked all the parameters correctly and got the best possible surface. It's an iterative process. Now, whether you change the parameters two times or five times or however many is really up to you and how good of a surface fit you want. But don't overly stress about exactly, well, do I use 10 neighbors or 12 neighbors? Don't worry about it. Just run it and look at the results and evaluate them, and then run it again with the other ones. It'll take you a couple minutes. It's not a big deal. So we want to make the surfaces, and then we want to look at those surfaces and evaluate them, understand the quality of that surface, how well did it predict that phenomenon, and then go back, change some parameters, maybe change interpolation techniques, and run it again and see what we get. So the first step of that is to understand your data. So we want to do what we call exploratory spatial data analysis, which is just a really fancy term for go look at your data, right? Visualize that data, spin it around, look at it, change the renderer, tweak it a little bit, and think about what kinds of things are actually happening in the data. So you're looking for outliers in the data. You want to understand where the highs and lows are. You just want to get a general feel for the trend of the data, right? So here's an example of some fisheries data. And if I just look at all the points on the left as black dots, all I see is the pattern that they were sampled. But as soon as I apply some color to those points and I look at them, I can see, oh, well, there's actually some high and low values, and there's a trend to that data that I, and you think about, oh, okay, well, I know where those fish were sampled, and I know what I'm looking for. Yeah, that kind of looks right. Or does it look completely wrong, right? So we have some tools in ArcGIS for helping you to explore that data, to look for outliers, to look for trends, to understand if there's this concept of spatial dependency. Is there some spatial trend to the data or some pattern to it that you recognize or maybe don't recognize in the data? Is it normally distributed? And if you're going to use a geostatistical technique, a classical geostatistic technique, is that data stationary? You know, is there some fixed structure to the data that can be fit with a single model? So with that, I think we'll switch over to Steve, and he will show us how to explore our data.
Thanks, Steve. So the first thing, we start looking at the data. You look at the map. Whoop, there's Vegas. If we get in the car, we can be there in 5 hours. 7 o'clock tonight, we can hit the tables. But if we look at data, as Steve mentioned, in this map, I've just got some point measurements or locations where ozone was sampled on the 6th of September 2007 at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. But if I just look at those points, I've already draped it on top of a map, so we know it's in California, and we can see where all the points are. If I just go and change the symbology, I've done it already, but to change the symbology, you would just right-click, go to Properties, Symbology, and you can change it. You can change the size, the colors. Then we already start seeing some patterns. The coast, we've got lower ozone values, and in this area, we've got some high ozone values. So one of the things we want to explore the data, one of the first things we want to look at, are there any outliers in the data, or where do the high values occur? Where do the low values occur? And if we're going to use one of the geostatistical methods, Kriging, for example, the data need to be normally distributed. To get to that, in the geostatistical toolbar, we'll go and look at the histogram, for example. We're looking at ozone values, and it's sort of a little bit skew, but it's not too bad. If I go and select the high values, they change to yellow. So I can see where the high ozone values are. Likewise, if I go to these two bars, the low ones are over there. It works the other way as well. If I go and select on the map, for example, those points, they're sort of in the middle somewhere. So this just gives me an idea of where my average values are, where my highs are, where my lows are, and is that what I expect? One of the other relationships that we want to look at is the idea of neighbors. We want to see points that are close to one another from Tobler's law need to be more alike than points far away. Now, on this semi-variogram cloud, we've got on the x-axis distance between points, and on the y-axis, we've got the difference between the measured values at those points. So if you look at these two points over here, for example, if I select them, it's between those two points. They're pretty far apart if you look at the distance. And if we go and look at the histogram, it's between low and high values. So I'm not too worried about this. These points aren't close to one another. But this tool, just having a look at the semi-variogram cloud, if, for example, those two points were right over here, I'd have a problem. You know, if I go and select that one down there, you can see the points are very close to one another, but it's not that extreme. And they're also not as different as those points are there. So this also gives you a nice spread of where the different relationships are between the values. We can also go and look at a Voronoi diagram or a Thiessen polygon, where we just calculate Thiessen polygons around these points. And for example, if I go and look at one of the types, standard deviation, I'm calculating the standard deviation, taking one polygon, calculating the standard deviation between that polygon and the points around it. And you want to see how different those values are. If they're very different, it means your data might not be stationary, and you might want to look at a different method. So these are some of the ESDA tools that we've got in the product that can help you analyze your data before you dive in and decide on an interpolation package.
Thanks, Steve. You guys come on in, have a seat. It's okay. Hang out for a while. All right, so to understand interpolators, the first thing to know is there's actually two parts to every interpolation technique. One is the neighborhood definition, or the way we figure out who the neighbors are that we're interested in looking at. And then the other is the estimation function, or the technique that we use to estimate that new value. So that neighborhood is really, where do I find all the measured values to help me estimate this new value? So we can specify those in a variety of ways, but normally we would specify that either as a distance radius, you know, I'm interested in all the points within 5 miles, or as a number of neighbors. Give me the 6 nearest points, or give me the 10 nearest points. Okay. Most of what we're going to talk about actually today, though, has to do with that estimation function. So from those points that define my neighbors that I'm going to use for this calculation, how do I calculate those new values? And there's some very simple techniques that we use, and there's some very sophisticated techniques that we use. And which one you choose will depend on the type of data that you have and the type of surface that you want to create. So just to finish up on the neighborhood definition part, there's really two ways that we specify those. We can specify a number of points, as I mentioned, or a fixed number of points. A fixed distance. So one of the things Steve mentioned was this idea of Tobler's first law of geography. And that is that everything is related to everything else, but that things that are closer together are more related, right? So this is a big assumption that we use in all interpolation techniques, which is if I'm trying to estimate values of water quality, and I'm standing here in the ocean, and I measure a value, and I stand here, my value probably didn't change very much. But if I measure a value way over there, there's a good chance that it's going to be very different. So that semivariogram cloud that Steve showed, that graph with all the points on it, where he could click on a point and see the point pair, where those things were in California and how different they were, helps us understand how these relationships occur in the data. Now, that's important when we start thinking about the neighborhood that we want to use, because we want to understand how large of a neighborhood I want to use in order to capture that phenomenon and not start to introduce noise from points that are too far away that I shouldn't need to consider them, right? One of the things that we can do inside of the geostatistical analyst tools is we can actually specify some sector neighborhoods. So instead of just using a circle with 10 points, we can say, use a circle with, say, 4 sectors and give me 2 points out of every sector. The reason we might want to do this is for data that's been sampled in a fairly consistent or patterned way. So this happens a lot with, like, bathymetry data and things like this, where we actually have these linear phenomena in the sampling pattern, where it becomes useful to select points from multiple sectors. So the next thing we want to talk about is the kind of questions that we want to ask about the data that will help us understand which type of interpolator we should use. So we talked earlier about the characteristics of the phenomenon. We talked a little bit about sample spacing. Now, in this case, what we're thinking about is the data very highly sampled or oversampled? Or do we need some amount of extrapolation? Is there very, very few points and we have these very vast areas that we need to estimate values for? Do we want to honor the input point values? Now, your intuitive thought is like, well, of course, I measured it there. I know that that's the value, right? Well, there's an assumption in a lot of these methods that there is a concept of measurement error. And measurement error means the value that you measured there is not really the actual value. It's something close to that. So the geostatistical techniques are built around this concept of measurement error and trying to create a surface that accounts for that error. We talked a little bit about discontinuous surfaces. So are there some kind of barriers in the surface? I'm trying to make a map of some geologic phenomenon and there's faults in the surface or something like that. We'll come back to that in a minute. Or are there some specialized applications? So hydrologic applications, for example. We'll show an example of that. So there's a lot of different interpolation techniques available in ArcGIS. And the good news is we're not going to talk about all of them today. We're going to talk about a few of them, and we're going to help you understand when to use each one. And that's not to say that you shouldn't use the other ones. It's just these are the ones that most of the time are most applicable to most people's problems. So why are there so many different ones? Well, if you look at those points, I'll just flip through a couple of maps here. And this is one type of surface we could create from those points. Now, all these surfaces that we're showing here used the same input values. This is another surface we could create from those points. Or this one. Or this one. Or this one. Or this one. Which one's the right one? I don't know. But we have ways to help figure that out, thankfully. But having you understand some things about that surface, about that phenomenon that you're trying to create, becomes very important. Now, what we don't want you to do is just run it and pick the one that looks the best. Because looks the best is very seldom actually the best surface. So it feels the best, but it's not mathematically the best. And when we talk about best, we're actually talking about, you know, what is the mathematically, statistically most correct surface or best approximation. So this is sort of one of the key slides that we're going to keep coming back to some of these pieces and lays the framework for the rest of what we're going to talk about, which is how to choose an interpolation method. And these are the methods that we're going to talk about most of the rest of this session and that Steve is going to demo. So the first one, you don't know anything at all about your data. Which interpolation method should you use? Well, we think you should use natural neighbors. And the reason we want you to use natural neighbors is it's the most conservative interpolator. And what that means is it's going to honor your input points and it's not going to introduce any interesting artifacts into the surface as a side effect of the algorithm, right? So it's basically a good way to get a first look at the data and what does the data really tell you the surface looks like. The second one is, well, I want something a little bit more than that, you know. One of the limitations of natural neighbors is it's not going to give you any high and low values beyond what was sampled. So I know that my surface is a little smoother than that. The highs and lows weren't sampled. What should I do? At that point, we would say move up to kernel interpolation or possibly to empirical Bayesian kriging or EBK. Don't be intimidated by the long name. It's actually much easier than it sounds. It's easier to use than it is to say. So we just call it EBK. If your surface is not continuous, then we would use kernel interpolation, which allows you to input barriers, or the spline with barriers tools. And we would use these if we know that there's some kind of faults or discontinuities in the data or in the surface. If your input data is contours, then really your only good option is to use the topo to raster tool. We'll talk more about that in a little bit. And if you really want to use a geostatistical technique, then our first recommendation would be to use EBK or empirical Bayesian kriging. So all these slides will be available online and the presentations are recorded, so you know, don't feel like you have to urgently scribble that down. So some considerations when we want to choose an interpolator. I've talked a few times about this idea of understanding the quality of the surface that we create. This is something that we call the prediction standard error or standard error of prediction. And this is something that we can get out of the geostatistical techniques and some other techniques, which is a measure of how good that surface is. We may want to deal with, as Steve was mentioning in his ESDA demo, we want to know if the data is normally distributed. We want to know if the data is stationary. We need to think about whether or not we want an exact interpolator or not, whether or not it supports barriers. And then the last one to think about is speed. Some of these methods are very, very fast. Some of them are not fast. So some of that is dependent upon the hardware you use. Some of these methods are actually implemented to take advantage of multi-core hardware. So if you have a quad-core machine, it's going to run a lot faster. It will take advantage of that. But some of them are actually just computationally very intensive. Now, the graphics that are up here are really just an illustration to show the different surfaces that I was showing that we created from multiple sets of points. This is a representation of two surfaces that I might create. The orange dots, obviously, are the points, and I'm looking at a profile. Now, the one at the top is what I would get if I was using something like a spline or a local polynomial or kriging or something like that, where I'm basically fitting a surface through the points and there's some sort of curve fitting going on. The one at the bottom is very similar to what you might get out of IDW. And I only point that out because everybody uses IDW, and there's not very many reasons other than as an educational tool or as an exploratory tool to actually use it. So if you notice on the previous slide, when we talked about which interpolator to use when you're not sure what to use, IDW was not one of them. So it's got a short name, it's easy to understand, but it's actually seldom the best interpolator for your data. So the first one that was on the list was natural neighbors. So this is the simplest and the safest interpolator for getting a feel for your data. This is the one we always recommend that you start with if you don't know anything about your data at all. Next down is kernel interpolation. And we want to use kernel interpolation as our next step because often what we're looking for is a continuous surface that has some modeling in it that deals with highs and lows, that extrapolates beyond the high and low values and fits some bit of a smooth surface to those points. We can also do this with EBK as well. So let's switch back over to Steve, and he's going to show us how to use some of these interpolators.
Okay. Thanks, Steve. We're back to using the same data set. If you haven't noticed, we're now not using ArcMap anymore. We're using Pro. Any of you using Pro?
A few? Okay.
So in this case, once again, we've got the ozone data over California, and we're going to look at these two interpolation methods. The first one, natural neighbor. To find that, I start typing. You see two of these tools come up in the search. The one is if you have a spatial analyst license. The other one is if you have a 3D license. They're exactly the same tool, no difference. Because we on the spatial analyst team, we'll pick the spatial analyst one. But we're responsible for both of them. As Steve mentioned, it doesn't have much. It's got the input feature class. You're going to pick a field. You're going to pick the output raster name and the cell size. So the only thing you've got to think about with natural neighbor is what cell size to use. Other than that, no thought, hit run. It's pretty quick, but I've already got one that I've run and symbolized. So this is looking at the ozone values using natural neighbor. The highs are in red, the lows are in blue. You see one thing, it doesn't extrapolate. It doesn't go outside the convex hull. So it doesn't produce anything in those areas. Now let's move over and look at the kernel interpolation. Kernel interpolation, there's only one version available. That's in geostatistical, with a geostatistical analyst license. And you can see it's got a few more parameters. I can input a barrier. In this case, we're not going to use a barrier. And other than that, it's got some ways that you can choose which polynomial to fit, etc. I've also created an output. Let's go to that. Swipe. And if you look at the difference between these two outputs, they more or less they're the same. You know, the reds are where the reds are, and the blues are in similar places. There are some differences. Some of the major differences you see, kernel interpolation does extrapolate, but it only extrapolates up to a point. I said only up to, in the model, only go as far as 180 kilometers outside the range. Now, one of the things with the geostatistical tools, and kernel interpolation is one of them, we can get a standard error prediction surface. And that's how it looks. Light red, small error, dark red, larger errors. So now you look at this extrapolation part. Remember, the natural neighbor only went that far, and the standard error shows you when you go outside that convex hull, you're actually making more and more, there's more uncertainty in your output. So be careful when you extrapolate too far outside your area of interest. So that's a quick introduction just to the two simplest interpolation tools in ArcGIS.
Thanks, Steve. So that question about Pro or ArcMap, we were just curious. Almost all the tools that are available to you are the same. There's a couple of exceptions that we will make note of as we get to them. But for the most part, all the things that we're talking about are available in both places. We're just curious. And we are actually in 10.5 going to have a new Geostat Wizard as well. I think it'll be make it in 10.5.
In hopefully. 1.4.
Sorry, 1.4. Yeah, it's already in 10.4. All right. Okay. So let's talk a little bit about some of these other ones. So one of the things Steve just showed us was this this prediction standard error map. How many people have seen one of those before or realized that that was something you could do? That is something that's extremely powerful when you start making surfaces with very sparse data to understand just how good those estimations are in those sparse areas, right? So we have a couple places we can do that. Kernel interpolation, which is where Steve showed that. In local polynomial interpolation, or LPI, and in all of the Krieging methods in geostatistical analysts, we can create this prediction standard error map. So, really nice feature. And actually, the implementation, even in ArcGIS Online, of interpolation actually uses EBK in the background and gives you the opportunity to create a prediction standard error map as well. So, let's say that the points that you sampled are perfect and you want to use an interpolator that absolutely honors those points. There's a few choices that you have. One of them is natural neighbors. Second one is spline, which is a smooth curve fitting algorithm. The radial basis functions that are available in geostatistical analyst and IDW. All the other interpolators that we have are what we call inexact interpolators, which means they will model a surface. It tries to fit through the points, but it's not required to exactly fit through the sample points. So, I mentioned this a few times. If the high and low values of your phenomena have not been sampled but are important to you, then you should not use IDW or Natural Neighbors. Now, the reason for that is because they will not extrapolate beyond the values that are already sampled. So if there's a high point in the data, an area of high values, whether it's elevation or chemistry or something else, if you know there's a high spot in the phenomenon or a low spot that hasn't actually been sampled, then you should not use these interpolators because they will not give you the high or low value that you're looking for. The other interpolation techniques will extrapolate beyond the input data values to try to fit a surface that would provide those high and low estimates for you. So, when you're using kriging, or when to use kriging, the first assumption is that the data is spatially correlated. And what that means is, in the semivariogram cloud diagram that Steve showed, we're just saying that the data is spatially correlated. What that means is, as I move to the left, to the right, in that semivariogram cloud, the similarity between the values of the points decreases. So I end up with what looks like down here in the bottom graph, right? So as I move further away in sample distance, the relationship between points decreases. So there is some spatial correlation. Sometimes you'll look at it and the data just looks like, you know, random points on a, you know, from a random point generator, where there is no spatial correlation. If there's no spatial correlation in the data, then you really can't use a geostatistical or kriging technique. And in fact, you're probably not going to end up with a very interesting surface anyway. The question of stationarity, we mentioned that earlier. Now, stationarity is important with most kriging algorithms because we fit a single variogram model to the entire data set. However, in EBK, we actually use a regionalized variogram, a moving window, so we don't actually have to have stationarity over the entire data set. What that means for people that are familiar with kriging already is the constraint of stationarity that prevented you from working over large geographies with a varying phenomenon, you don't have to worry about as much with EBK because we're actually using multiple variogram models, not a single variogram for the entire data set. Now, as Steve mentioned, one of the requirements of kriging is that your data is normally distributed. If you look at the histogram of the data and it's not normally distributed, there are tools in the wizard, in the geostatistical wizard, to allow you to transform your data to a normal distribution. Now, if you know that the thing that you're trying to model is highly correlated with some other phenomenon that is measured more, then there's some other techniques that you can use to create a better surface. Now, the one that's been in geostatistical analysis for a long time is co-kriging. And with co-kriging, you can specify another variable that is sampled at all of the same places that you have sample points. Now, a new one that we added into Pro 1.2, was EBK regression prediction. And what this is a form of empirical Bayesian kriging which does multivariate regression, a spatial multivariate regression. Now, the constraint of that is that in order to make estimates at all of these locations, you need to actually have all of these other variables at those locations as well, which means you need to have raster data sets of all of these things that you want to correlate with. So if you think about something like trying to make a map of precipitation, I'm going to steal your demo idea. It's the first one that came to mind. So I'm going to make a map of precipitation. Steve's going to make a map of precipitation. What is precipitation highly correlated with that might be well sampled? Any ideas? Elevation. See, you guys are thinking, right? So we can actually use elevation as a secondary variable to help improve our precipitation estimates, right? I talked a little bit about this a minute ago. I mentioned empirical Bayesian kriging. This is a form of kriging that we developed. And what it allows you really to do is, how many of you guys have used kriging in the past? A few of you. Okay. Wow. Actually, a good percentage of you. So for those of you who haven't, one of the things that you need to do with kriging is you need to build a variogram model. You need to explore the data and fit a model to the data. And the type of surface that you get out has a lot to do with how well you fit that model. With EBK, we actually can auto-fit that model, and we use a regionalized approach. And what that allows us to do is to get a more robust surface out with a lot less effort by you. So one of the things that we did a few years ago was we actually sent a survey out to all the geostatistical analyst users, and we said, you know, do you use GA? Are you, you know, really skilled in geostatistics? And a whole lot of questions. And what we found is even people who said they knew a lot about geostatistics took the defaults quite frequently. So we went back and decided, well, then the most useful thing we could do is figure out how to make better default values. So that was when a few years ago an optimize button showed up on a few parameters in the wizard where you could actually take a little bit more time and we would do some simulation in the background and estimate better parameters for you. We took what we learned from that and used that as a way to fit these variogram models inside of EBK for you. And to be honest, it fits better models than most of us can fit ourselves by hand because it does many, many simulations. So if you're interested in a kriging technique or a geostatistical technique, EBK is the one that that we recommend. And this is also the one that's implemented inside of ArcGIS Online. Okay, so let's jump over to Steve. He will show us how to krieg a surface.
The data set has changed a little bit. We're moving further south to South Africa. In my previous life, I worked with rainfall data in South Africa. You can, yeah, I've got an accent. That's where my accent is from. So this is a subset of the South African rainfall database. It's 1,000 rain gauges scattered over the country. South Africa is about 1 million square kilometers, a little bit bigger than Texas. And these are the mean annual precipitation values measured in millimeters, and we want to fit a surface, a mean annual precipitation surface over South Africa. And I'm going to use EBK to do that. I've already run it. I've got an EBK layer. So from the layer, I can open up the geostatistical wizard. And in the wizard, we come onto this page. So these are all the parameters. This is how the preview surface looks. And this is one of the semi-variograms. Now, as Steve mentioned, we do some subsetting. We've got at least 100 points in a subset, and we're doing 100 simulations. The output surface is a prediction surface. We aren't doing any transformations. If the data weren't normally distributed, we could have applied a transformation. For example, a good one to apply for this data would be log empirical, which would mean that the data would be transformed to a normal distribution, but the values would always be positive. So in rainfall data, that's pretty good. You're never going to get any negative rainfall amount. So we could choose that one. For the demo, I didn't. It's just quicker not using it. So as I click around, you'll see the semi-variogram cloud at the bottom changes. These are different semi-variogram models that are being applied as we move through in these subsets. One of the things Steve also mentioned earlier on about using all the processing power on your computer, EBK, for example, or all the geostatistical interpolation tools will use all the processors on your machine. If you've got a 32-core machine, by default, it'll use all 32 cores. You can go and change it and make it smaller, but by default, it'll use what you got. It's a pretty computationally intensive routine to do this, and we're doing it 100 simulations. On the next page, we've got cross-validation. Cross-validation is an important part in seeing how good these predictions are that we're making. What cross-validation does, it takes the first point out of the data set, it hides it. It makes a prediction to that location, compares the predicted value to the observed value, puts that residual aside, puts that point back, removes the next one, predicts to that location, etc., and it does that for all of them. And the statistic that it calculates is this root mean square error, that value over there. So you want to minimize that value. This is the one-to-one line of measured versus predicted values. We want to make sure that that's on the straight, this basically 45-degree line. Because we're in the wizard, I can go back. I can change one of these parameters. And then next, I can go and look how this value changes. Once I've gone back and forward a few times and I've got a good value, I can hit finish. These are all the parameters that I'm using for EBK. And I'm not going to create the surface because I've already created one. And that's more or less how it looks. Now, in South Africa with the rainfall, this area very dry, the desert area, this is Namibia, Botswana up there, Cape Town down here, a lot of rainfall variability. And on this side, there's also some close to the coast and inland. So this is a general overview of the surface. I've used EBK. I didn't use EBK regression prediction. So in this case, I'm only using the rainfall values. In a while, I'll be applying the elevation surface to show you how this one changes. Just to give you an idea, this is the standard error prediction map. So in some of these areas, we've got more uncertainty than in others. And it is available as a geoprocessing tool. And if I go into Geostatistical Analyst, Empirical Bayesian Kriging, there's the tool. So this is one of the, it's a fairly easy tool to use when it comes to Kriging. You don't have to go and worry about the variography.
Okay. Good. Thanks, Steve. So Kriging can be easy, right? Don't be intimidated. You can do it. So let's change gears a little bit. We talked, I mentioned earlier about discontinuous surfaces. So the graphic here is a sandstone surface, I believe it was, a geologic surface that contains some faults or discontinuities. And what that means is it's a continuous phenomenon except where there's some gaps or faults in the data. And because of the nature of interpolators and the fact that they want to try to fit a curve through a set of points, they assume that things that are close together are very similar. When you hit a discontinuity where you have two measured values that are significantly different but spatially very close together, it'll just completely whack out an interpolator and you just get a mess. So when you know that you have discontinuities in the surface, it's important to include some barrier or break line features to help model around those. And we have two different ways to do that. One is with the geostatistical analyst tools, either kernel interpolation or diffusion interpolation with barriers. Both support this, as well as the spline with barriers tool in spatial analyst. If any of you came from a oil and gas or mining background, the spline with barriers tools uses an algorithm very similar to something that was inside of ZMAP, if you'd used that in the past. So it uses a straight line barrier exclusion, which means I can't see around the points. So if we look at, for example, the support for barriers in IDW, right? I can't see a point that's, you know, behind the barrier, but in the other tools, I can actually, in a sense, use the distance around the barrier as a way to find that point as input. So I think it's more interesting to actually see an example of that. So we'll flip back to Steve.
So this one, we back in ArcGIS Pro, and we've moved further north, Shetland Islands, Ireland, Great Britain, or Brexit is over here. And this is Norway, and we've got some shale thickness values in this area. Let's zoom in a little bit. And I've got a subset of these shale thickness values. This is for a CO2 storage exercise that they did. This is the thickness of the shale in meters, and the black lines are barriers. So you can see between this side and this side, you've got red on the one side and you've got yellow on the other side. There's a pretty sharp drop in the shale thickness on that fault line. So for this, we'll use the kernel interpolation tool, the same one we used earlier. Just this time, we'll put in a barrier feature class. So the output that I get out of this tool, let's turn off those. And then the neat thing about this, I can run it with a barrier and without a barrier. So in this case, this is the output that I created without using a barrier. And you can see it moves over the barrier line, and this one is using it with the barrier. If I move to these two and I use the swipe map, the swipe tool, you can see as I turn the one layer off, everywhere it's more or less the same, except when we get to these fault lines. This is the one with barrier, and that's the one without the barrier. So then you can get it that it'll stop at the line and it'll be discontinuous. The other one, it doesn't know about this line and it'll just interpolate across it. As Steve mentioned, I've got a value here and I've got a value here. What's it going to do in between? It'll just do something like that. Whereas if I put a fault line in, I can get that discontinuity. So that's interpolation in the presence of barriers.
Thanks, Steve. So one of the things that I mentioned at the beginning was this idea of using contours as input. Contours are unique when used as an input to an interpolation tool because of this same phenomenon that things that are closer together are assumed to be more similar. The thing about contours is a contour line is a line with a lot of vertices in it, and every one of those vertices has the same value, the same height value, right? So if I'm looking at elevation contours, this contour line is 120 meters all the way along that contour line, everywhere it goes. So if I use a standard interpolation technique that just looks at points, and I just use the vertices, and I looked at a neighborhood with a contour line running through it, what values do you think I get? All the values on that line. So what other values do I get to use? Well, what if none of the contours fall into that search neighborhood, right? So in order to get around this, we have a specialized tool called TopoToRaster, which is intelligent about how it works with contour data. And it was primarily developed for creating hydrologically correct elevation surfaces for doing hydrologic modeling, but there's just an option on the tool to turn that off called drainage enforcement. If you're going to create a surface from contour lines that's not elevation for hydrologic purposes, just turn off the drainage enforcement. And when you do that, it'll work really intelligently with your contour data, and you'll get a nice surface, but it won't try to do this drainage enforcement thing. Now, there's a few other characteristics of TopoToRaster. It takes points as input as well, so you can give it contour lines and spot heights. So, for example, you have contours and you have the tops of mountains that were all sampled, for example. You can give it streams as input, and it'll use those sort of as break lines to enforce downslope drainage. You can give it points that represent sinks or known depressions in the landscape, and it'll model around those, as well as lakes and cliffs and a variety of other things. A lot of stuff in there that's really, really nice tool. It's built on top of a package called ANUDEM, which stands for Australia National University, DEM, developed by a guy named Mike Hutchinson. It's a really nice tool. And I think in the interest of time, I'll quit rambling about it and I'll let Steve show it to you.
We're still in ArcGIS Pro. You see the neat thing of Pro, I've got one project and these are all the views that I've got. So we just south of Lake Tahoe, and in this case, we've got contour data, elevation contours. We've got some spot heights, the red dots, the blue lines are streams, and the blue polygons are lakes. And we want to take all of this information and turn that into a digital elevation model. This is the Topo Terrasta tool. I put in a feature layer. I've got a boundary. I've got contours. I've got lakes. I've got streams. And then the cell size. In this case, I created a 10-meter cell size. And the parameter that Steve was speaking about, the drainage enforcement, you've got the option enforce, do not, or enforce with sync. I've already run the tool. It takes about a minute and a half to 2 minutes for this data set. And this is how the output looks. I'm just going to zoom in a little bit more. So it's gone through and it's taken all of that information and it's created a raster. So for every pixel, in this case, every 10-meter pixel, we've now got an elevation value. And I've rendered it as a pseudo 3D map. Easy to do. Let me quickly show you. You create the output, and you take this output and you run it through the spatial analyst tool Hillshade, which goes and creates a hillshade of the area. So this is how the hillshade map looks. You can see where the ridges are, where the streams are, and where the lakes are. On top of that, I can put the elevation surface that I've just created, and I can change the transparency. Look what happens if I give it zero transparency. It just looks like a normal map. And if I give it 20% or 20% transparency, it lets through some of this hillshade that I've got at the bottom, and it looks like a professional map. And if I put on all the contours and all of that information, it really looks cool. So there's a quick 30-second how to change your drab DEM into a good-looking DEM.
Thanks, Steve. Okay, so one of the things that I mentioned at the beginning was, what if you had polygons as input? And polygons as input is actually not really all that uncommon, because a lot of data, particularly data that has to do with people, demographic data, public health data, and things like that, is aggregated data. We never get the actual samples. You don't actually get a data set that says, well, we went to this house for the census and we asked how many people live there and what their ages were and what their health records were and whatever. Like, unless you're inside the government, you never get to see that data. But what happens when we have something like obesity data, and we have that data aggregated by school zones? So this is in LA County, and we had obesity data by school zones, and we wanted to look at obesity data by census blocks. So in statistical language, this is what's called a change of support problem. I have some data that's in polygons, and I want to put it in some other polygons. How do we actually do that? Traditionally, the way that we do that with a GIS is we just take the polygon and we overlay it with the other polygon and we say, well, there was 20% of it was this and 20% of it was that and 60% of it was that, and we just average it out, right? Doing it that way is, I don't want to say it too strong. It's wrong. I'll be honest. Okay, the problem with that is there's an assumption, and that assumption is that the phenomenon is homogeneous within the polygon, which we know that it's not, right? If you grabbed any particular school zone, let's say it's red, and that means there's a really high obesity rate for students within that polygon. There's not a same obesity rate for every house in that polygon, right? So what we did was we developed a technique called aerial interpolation, which allows us to take that aggregated data, turn it back into a continuous surface, and then allow you to re-aggregate it into some other polygons. Now, the way that we do that is using some geostatistical techniques, and therefore one of the side effects of that is we can actually give you a prediction standard error surface that shows you how good that surface fits the original polygon data, right? So it's not just, you know, a blind re-aggregation of your data. You can actually look at how good those estimations are. So if you get into a situation where you have some polygon data that you need to re-aggregate into some other polygons, or you have polygon data that you just need to turn into a continuous surface, this is a way that you can do that with the aerial interpolation tool in the Geostatistical Analyst. We also mentioned that we had this new tool coming in Pro 1.2, or in Pro 1.2, which is already out, called EBK Regression Prediction, so Empirical Bayesian Kriging Regression Prediction. So this is a spatial regression, a multivariate spatial regression that uses a Kriging technique. And what it allows us to do is take a set of points with a set of ancillary variables that help to describe the phenomenon and to create a new surface. It uses EBK, so it's that framework, with some additional what we call explanatory variables that are represented as raster data sets. We transform those using a principal component analysis, and then we can use those in a regression model to help improve our ability to predict these new values. So it helps us, by using the PCA, it gets rid of this fundamental problem of multicollinearity, of having a lot of variables that actually describe the same thing, which is very common when you're dealing with particularly natural resources data, where some of the variables that you're using might be elevation, slope, and aspect, which are hugely correlated, right? So if you throw all those into a traditional regression model, you just can't really predict what's going to happen. So we implemented this EBK regression prediction tool that allows us to do that. And so Steve's going to talk about this. And basically what we're able to do here is to take on the left this original EBK result and an elevation surface, and then create what you see on the right as a much more refined representation of that surface, right?
I'm going to use the same South African rainfall data set I used earlier on, move down just a little bit northeast of Cape Town. In this mountainous area, so this is the topography and those are the rain gauges. You can see you don't have many rain gauges in the mountainous area. So if you just use straightforward EBK, because there aren't any values on the mountains to show it that it should increase the rainfall, you're getting this flat surface across the mountains. Whereas with EBK regression prediction, we've got this explanatory variable that we can use. In this case, I just used one explanatory variable. For this example, I just used the elevation surface, this one. And that's the surface that it produces. But let's do this swipe again. Swipe between the two layers. It's generally the same as the regular EBK. It's just more pronounced in certain areas. You can see where there's no elevation, the blues are all the same, but it's in this mountainous area where it's going to push the rainfall up a little bit. So this is very useful in cases like this where you don't have points sampled everywhere and a very dense sampling of data.
Thanks, Steve. All right, I talked a little too slow, so I have 4 slides and 4 minutes. So hold on. So One of the things that we talked about that we wanted to make sure you did was understand how good your surface is. So we've talked about the standard error or prediction standard error surfaces that you can create out of these tools. Steve showed the cross-validation inside of the geostatistical wizard. And the other thing to know about is if you want to do your own validation, cross-validation, there is a tool called subset features, which allows you to pull out a random sample from your point data set that you can use to push back and analyze the quality of your surface. There's a couple non-interpolation things that, or I should say non-interpolation solutions to some problems people commonly have. So one of those is, if you have a lot of input points that are already equally spaced, it's basically gridded data already, but it's just points, take a look at the points to raster tool. You may not need to do any kind of interpolation at all. So there's actually a tool that allows you to take regularly spaced grid of points and turn them directly into a raster data set without doing any sampling or curve fitting or anything. It just turns it into a raster. So if you have regularly gridded data, take a look at that. If you have a lot of points, like really oversampled data, LiDAR data or some other phenomena that's really oversampled, you have like dozens of points per output cell that you're looking at, you can also look at using the points to raster tool. And what the points to raster tool allows you to do is to pick what kind of value you want. You can take, for example, the mean value of all points within a cell, or you could calculate, you know, use the max value or the min value. There's a variety of statistics in there that you can use. What if you're working with very, very large input data? So we'll commonly use points to raster for that because we want to represent, for example, the most frequent values, or we want to look at some statistical measures of the data. We can use smaller input extents. So maybe we don't need a map of the entire country. Maybe we just need a map of a portion of the country. So we would set the analysis extent to be a smaller area, and then we don't need to read all of that data. And then the other option would be to use the subset features tool to grab just a subset of that data. So finally, the slide to remember is about the workflow, really. So we've given you some pointers on how to pick interpolators and some understanding of how interpolators work, but really what we want you to come away with is this idea that there is some tools for exploring and understanding your data. We want you to experiment with different interpolation techniques and parameters to look at the quality of those surfaces statistically, you know, look at the cross-validation, look at the standard error, and understand whether or not you have a good surface or not. And then refine those parameters until you get a surface that you're actually comfortable with. So with that, we ask you to please fill out your surveys. We do actually get all of those sent back to us, and we use that information to update our presentations and try to provide you guys with information that you'd find useful. So sorry we got close to the end. Here's a slide I'll just leave up. This is a bunch of related sessions related to interpolation and geostatistical analysts and other things that are going on this week if you want to learn some more about it. I'm actually headed downstairs to the Spatial Analysis Pavilion if you guys have follow-up questions you don't want to ask publicly. Are you going to the island also?
Too.
Yeah, so we're going to both be downstairs later. So
I'll be there till 6:30. Yeah. I think it closes at 6. But.
Yeah, so with that, anybody have any questions? Yes. Right. So the difference between spatial analyst and 3D analyst when it comes to creating surfaces is 3D analyst has all the same interpolators for taking points and creating rasters, but 3D analyst has all of the other tools for creating tins and terrains, which are not part of spatial analyst. So if you want to work with tins and terrains and triangles and LiDAR data and things like that, those are all part of the 3D extension. Yes?
Tools to discover barriers.
So
you have a data set that doesn't make it.
Interesting question.
One way. One of the ways you could do it depends how densely your data are sampled. If your points are very densely sampled, like with this shale exercise that I've got, you know, where I've just taken a subset of the data, you could then just use any interpolator. The one Steve hates, IDW, because it's fast, and you give it a very small search neighborhood. And then when you plot it out, you could see areas where there's an abrupt change or where the changes are. Because remember, your points are close to one another. And then have a look at that map and then try and see, well, there's something going on here. Or if you've got points close to one another and there's a large difference, first, is it an outlier or is it a barrier? And then what... Is there some place you could find out more about these barriers, you know, geologic map or?
The other thing you could do is just, you know, with whatever interpolator you use, take that surface result and run the slope tool on it and look for areas of really crazy high slope, and that would be an indication of something strange happening. Yeah. Sure. Yes. Mm-hmm. For bathymetry data? How was it sampled? So is it now a regularly spaced grid, or do you have track lines from the sampling? Well, once you've actually created the surface and it has artifacts in it, it would be hard to fix that. You might want to take the original track line data and try to reinterpolate that, maybe with like kernel smoothing with like a four quadrant neighborhood, because you have track lines in the original data, right? Yeah. So if you use the four part quadrant neighborhood, that's really designed for working with data like that has those sort of sampling issues.
In the latest or previous version of ArcUser, one of our colleagues put a paper in there how to sample. How to interpolate that type of data. Constantine did it with track data.
Earlier, that was in January or something.
Yeah.
Earlier this year, yeah.
ArcUser. When we're done, are you coming down to the pavilion, the expo center? Come look me up. I'll be down there in about 10 or 15 minutes, and we can search for it online. It's in one of the recent publications.
Not an uncommon question. Visually or analytically?
Analytically, I suppose, yeah. I guess the space-time cube and this cluster-time analysis, they got fitted to...
No, not really. I mean, what's the application that you're working with?
Well, in order to...
Like 3D, like continuous 3D... Okay. I'm just trying to be very specific because it's very different things. You're like, oh, 3D polygon shells for visualization.
No,
or,
yeah, you're right.
Yeah, okay.
In this one, you could just take contour shells. So you could draw contour lines, and then in those, call it those shells of the contour lines, you can then just
you
pull
step
those.
Through it. I guess
yeah,
thing
you could. You could pull
yeah.
through.
What some people will do to approximate a true 3D volumetric model is they'll actually model slices, right? And then you can measure, yeah, and then you can visualize all those slices together. But I mean, the other thing you can do is you know, store it as a, you know, a point cloud in a netcdf file or something like that. And then there's some specialized techniques that we have for visualizing some of those kinds of data. We don't actually have a really full-blown, fully continuous 3D data structure native to the system yet. It's under design. We've been working on it for a while, but we're probably going to end up with something like netcdf point clouds that we interpolate on the fly into shells. But yeah, okay. I'd be interested to understand your application a little bit more to help me think about that project.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Anything else? Okay. Well, thank you. We'll see some of you downstairs.